John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And we learned over the weekend that Brian Williams is taking a few days off while NBC News investigates his possibly trumped-up stories about being in danger in Iraq.
I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago. It did not take long to hear from some brave men and women in the air crews who were also in that desert. I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
This saga, to me, is at once irresistible. It's deeply sad and a stratospheric fall from grace. It's almost Shakespearean. How strange these network anchors are in our time. Princely Hamlets, both anointed and burdened with a role that outwardly confers its significance, but inwardly denies it, apparently. I succumbed to the temptation to nastily tweet along with the gleeful multitudes last week, but Williams' credibility crisis goes deeper than petty online graffiti. And it's a bit personal in my case. I went to school with a kid named Brian Williams. No relation. He was perfect, though. Grades, grooming, penmanship, anointed for greatness. And in 1993, when I came to New York and started working in television, I ran into a rising star named Brian Williams almost immediately. Different guy, of course. But this perfection haunted me. Brian Williams was hired at NBC News the same year I was hired at ABC News. The word was that someday he would replace the untouchable Tom Brokaw. Brian Williams was the one.
That was a great story. For them and for us, it's personal.
In late August of 1996, I was in Chicago as part of MSNBC's coverage of the Democratic National Convention. I was anchoring specials on politics nestled in and around Brian's primetime coverage. On the night before President Clinton's ritual official nomination, I came back to the hotel to find Brian beaming with an almost giddy smile. "It's happened," he said to me. "This is the big one. This is why I got into this business." Brian and most of the press corps were ecstatic over what came to be known and then quickly forgotten as the Dick Morris scandal. Whether he meant it or not, when he said that such gotcha moments were why he got into broadcasting, I knew it was not why I had become a journalist. In fact, by 1996, I was wondering exactly why I had gotten into television from radio, as it was becoming clear that there were rocky roads ahead for the whole profession, especially this idea of the anchor.
Nightly news begins now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams.
I've worked with TV anchors, and they all have enormous burdens of destiny and identity to carry. Dan Rather was the first storm chaser from local TV to make it at the network. Peter Jennings was in his 20s when he was tapped for the anchor chair at ABC for the first time and was always uneasy about his inexperience and that he had no college degree. It was an insecurity he worked hard in the field to eventually overcome. Tom Brokaw was a veteran beat reporter, but he was co-host of the chatty Today Show, as much about celebrities and recipes as news, when he became the sole face of NBC Nightly News in 1983. Brokaw rose to the top and eventually got his creds by writing the Greatest Generation books. They were stories of World War II told by people who had been in the thick of it to a network anchor who openly wondered if there was something wanting in the people of his generation. Those books solidified Brokaw as a person beyond TV, and it helped catapult NBC to number one. Brian Williams watched all of this. I can only wonder what special burdens of identity he carried. It was such a foregone conclusion that he was to be anchor after Brokaw that his foibles and elitist tendencies were deemed trivial. Brian rubbed shoulders with Jack Welch at GE. He went on Leno and, we were told, took the GE jet to exotic locations to shoot his stand-up segments. His live vamps and his often overlong interview questions were tolerated while people admired his sense of humor and his ability to always look perfect. But here's the Shakespeare part. If it's true that he lied about his experience in Iraq, you have to wonder why someone at the top of his profession, with enough awards, ratings, and compensation for three careers in journalism, would try and grab some ultimate brass ring. Did he so covet the near-death experiences in Iraq of Bob Simon, Bob Woodruff, and Kimberly Dozier, and others, that he had to invent being fired on in a chopper, invent fearing for his life, concoct some melodramatic shrapnel wounds from one of America's most troublesome conflicts? Does this get you into some new greatest generation?
This was a bungled attempt by me to thank one special veteran and, by extension, our brave military men and women, veterans everywhere, those who have served while I did not. I hope they know they have my greatest respect and also now my apology.
Williams has given us an ultimate Dick Morris Twitter moment about himself. And that's the irony. Whether true or not, Williams' focus on his own story may have delayed him from understanding the wars themselves were misguided. Had he been first with that story, he might have qualified to be in the greatest generation after all. It's not clear how this investigation will turn out or what the future of the last real TV news star will be, but after almost 25 years of wondering, it's clear to me now that Brian Williams is no Brian Williams. And let's look at some real news today. German Chancellor Angela Merkel meets with President Obama today as part of a high-level effort, including French President Francois Hollande, British Prime Minister David Cameron, to convince Vladimir Putin to honor a ceasefire agreement that was made back in September between the Ukrainian government and Russian-backed separatist forces. Germany and the U.S. disagree on whether to send weapons to the Ukrainian army. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry told Meet the Press the U.S. will do what it takes to keep Ukraine out of Putin's hands.
The solution is a political, diplomatic one, but President Putin's got to make the decision to take an off-ramp, and we have to make it clear to him that we are absolutely committed to the sovereignty and integrity of Ukraine, no matter what.
Ann Applebaum, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post and Slate, says that far from off-ramp, Vladimir Putin seems to be motoring down a path that may change the face of Europe more dramatically than at any period since the end of the Cold War. Ann Applebaum, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello.
What do you think happens if nothing can be achieved in these latest talks at the highest levels of Germany, France, the U.S.?
Well, what we could be facing is the possibility of a Russian partial occupation of eastern Ukraine. We could be facing the creation of what's called a new frozen conflict. In other words, a piece of Ukrainian territory, which is effectively controlled by Russia, which can then be used to disrupt and undermine Ukraine into the near future. Of course, what we could also be facing is a Russia which is emboldened by this achievement and attempts to try it again somewhere else. So they've done it before. They've done it in Moldova. They did it in Georgia in 2008. Now they've done it in Ukraine. Next could be the Baltic states. It could be another Russian neighbor. We just don't know.
In humanitarian terms, does the breakdown of these talks, if they don't succeed, mean more violence and a significant upgrade in the violence or escalation of the violence?
It really depends on what the Russians want. The latest round of violence was begun by the so-called separatists. They appear to have decided that they need greater territory. They would like to control more space. And so they began attacking new towns and trying to expand the borders of their little statelet. And so it much depends on whether the Russians decide they want to keep going or whether they decide to freeze the conflict where it is. If the Russians decide to stop, then the talks, of course, could end the conflict, at least for now. But, of course, there's no guarantee that it wouldn't continue again in the future.
Is there any interest in Putin stopping the conflict? There's certainly a theoretical interest in him projecting his power and Russian nationalism by pursuing it, even with the pain of sanctions and lower oil prices right now.
Well, look, he began the conflict, and you know, for reasons of his own, he wants to continue it. This is very important for him internally. In effect, he's making an argument to the Russian people. Look what happens to you if you try to join Europe. You know, look what happens if you try to become part of the West. What he really wants to prevent is a Ukraine which is even minimally prosperous, even minimally Western, even minimally integrated, because that would then be a challenge to Russia. If Ukraine can do it, then why can't Russia?
Much has been written about the relationship between Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin, the fact that she speaks Russian, that she grew up in East Germany, that she sort of understands the Russian mentality, both for good and ill. Is there a chance that Putin would want to make some kind of side deal with Germany to project some bipolar power structure in Europe that would be fundamentally different from the U.S. involvement?
Yes, I think that has been Putin's goal all along. His goal has been to have a special relationship with Germany. His goal has been to undermine the European Union, to undermine NATO, to pick apart the post-Cold War and indeed the post-war settlement in Europe. That has been his goal. So far, Angela Merkel, who I think understands this very well, has not agreed to do that. She remains anchored to Germany's role in NATO. She remains attached to her allies, particularly those in Central Europe. I think the Polish-German relationship, which was created over the last 7 or 8 years, is very important here. You know, Germany feels now a responsibility for its immediate neighbors that it might not have felt earlier. So far, it hasn't worked. So far, the Germans are on side, you know, but this is a very long game. Putin is using tools of corruption, of political influence, of support for the far right, sometimes the far left, all over Europe. He's a supporter of the new far left government in Greece, as well as its far right coalition partners. So it's not even an ideological game. It's all about being anti-establishment. And he's playing for the long victory. So, you know, he may outlast Merkel. We'll have to wait and see.
Finally, what do you make of the reports that Cyprus may grant Russia a military bases on that island in the Mediterranean, and that Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former commander of NATO, suggested, as you did a moment ago, that Putin might have his eyes on the Baltics?
Putin's made very clear that he has his eye on the Baltics. There have been a number of incidents over the last few weeks and months in the Baltics. There was an Estonian security officer who was kidnapped by the Russians over the border. Small provocative incidents have been going on for a long time. You know, the Cyprus story, I was told yesterday that it's actually, there's nothing new, that the Russians have been refueling in Cyprus for a long time. Although, of course, it's true that Cyprus and its relationship to Russia is also part of the game. Cyprus's economy is dependent on Russian money laundering. That's what is done in Cyprus. That's why there's so much Russian property there and so much Russian influence. And what the Russians do in Cyprus, they would like to do elsewhere in Europe. So yes, it is this is a strategy. The strategy is to pick off the weaker European states one by one, whether financially or politically or militarily, to weaken the European Union, to weaken NATO, to get the U.S. out of Europe, and to have Europe become a zone of Russian influence and a playground for Russian corruption that would suit the people who run Russia now. That is the strategy.
A vivid picture of the situation in Europe way beyond eastern Ukraine. Ann Applebaum, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Ann Applebaum is foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post and Slate. And later this hour, beauty is, from Austin, Texas, good health, open mind, positive attitude. From Anoka, Minnesota, my family, my wife, my children. From New York, New York, what you do when nobody's looking. In a week-long exploration of beauty, later this hour, we begin in Greece.
The term in Greek that was often rendered as beautiful had a very large range of meanings, even larger than the English beautiful.
That's classicist David Konstan. More from him later. And we're asking you, can you define beauty in 6 words?
I'm Wesley from Ogden, Utah, and beauty is falling in love with the universe.
You can join our conversation. Tell us in 6 words by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or 1,000 words by sharing a photo. Tweet us at The Takeaway with the hashtag MyBeautyIs or post a picture to facebook.com/TheTakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by GiftedAndTalented.com, providing personalized online courses developed by Stanford University, designed to help K-12 students advance in mathematics, language arts, and beyond. More at GiftedAndTalented.com.
One of you who responded to our call for a definition of beauty in 6 words sent this poignant message.
This is Sarissa Wilhelmy in Anchorage, Alaska. Surviving cancer with dignity and grace.
Not bad. That survival is dependent on many things, and the odds of survival are not so pretty for African-American men when it comes to prostate cancer. Black men are more than twice as likely as white men to die from prostate cancer. In partnership with WNYC's Living Cancer series, we look now at how the science of cancer research can fail real people with cancer. Elsie McCord followed all the rules for being vigilant about prostate cancer after pushing to have his PSA, prostate-specific antigen level, tested at age 50 and learning he had prostate cancer. 12 years later, Elsie is now living cancer-free as a professor emeritus of biology at the New College of Florida. But how Elsie managed to beat the odds and what the lower survival rate for African-American men means is the subject of our conversation with Elsie and Dr. Dorado Brooks, Director of Prostate and Colorectal Cancers for the American Cancer Society.
Well, one of the challenges is we don't really understand the biologic underpinnings of the higher rates that we see in black men. And this is not just African-American men, but men of West African origin around the globe have higher rates of prostate cancer and are more likely to die of the cancer. They also are more likely to be diagnosed at earlier ages, and there's some evidence that those earlier cancers may be of the more aggressive form. So there are some things that we don't understand, but we do know that many black men don't get the same quality of treatment, and that can be because of insurance issues, lack of access. There are a lot of men are simply fearful and don't pursue a diagnosis. Many men, unfortunately, in the situation where they have an elevated PSA level will simply refuse to follow up, not recognizing that finding the cancer and treating it early can save their lives.
Elsie McCord, can you describe your diagnosis and how you felt about the vulnerability to prostate cancer as you began to age out of your 40s?
Yes. I became 50 in 1999, and I needed a baseline PSA because being a scientist, I knew that blacks had a higher propensity of this disease than others. And so I went to my GP and asked for a PSA following the digital rectal exam, and he said that I was too young and that I shouldn't take the exam. So I said, I really need the baseline. And he said, okay, it'll cost you $50. So I paid the $50, and the results was 3.4 nanograms per deciliter. But since he said my prostate was small and pliable, I didn't worry about it. I went back to my doctor 3 years later, and I asked the same question. And he said, well, if I'm a betting man, I'd bet you were fine. And I said, I'm not a betting man. Please give me the test. The results was 6.4 nanograms per deciliter. And now I became concerned because the PSA was on the rise.
And what was your treatment, and how are you doing right now?
I'm doing fine. It's been 12 years since I've been treated. What happened was I read review articles on the survival rates of different modalities, like operations and so forth. And at that time, operation was the gold standard. And I found myself over time in information overload. But the final choice or modality was brachytherapy.
What's your impression of Elsie McCord's story, Dr. Brooks?
Well, first, I would applaud Mr. McCord because he's done exactly what it is that we recommend that men do when they're facing a prostate cancer diagnosis, and that is do the research. There are many men for whom surgery actually is a very reasonable and maybe the best approach. But all too often, men who are told they have cancer have the immediate response, get it out, just take care of it. And they don't take the time to recognize that there are other treatment options.
So, Elsie, how does that don't ask, I don't want to know kind of mentality play out in your community of friends?
The medical establishment in the black community has had a tumultuous relationship for quite a long time, and there's a distrust there. I have to agree with that. But then there's another factor in the men that I've talked to, and they ask me what is involved in screening, and I tell them the digital rectal exam, and some of them says no one is going to approach that part of their body. And it appears that there's some form of homophobia there. But it doesn't make any sense to me because some of these same guys risk their lives of drinking and driving and texting and driving. And a lot of these things can actually end your life a lot quicker than the digital rectal exam.
Have you ever convinced anyone to get the exam and heard those kinds of excuses, those kinds of fears?
Yes, we have screenings often. And I generally give a talk at the event. And a lot of people come up and talk to me in private because they somehow have this innate fear that some of their friends have had a negative reaction or they didn't get cured. And so therefore, by the time the story gets to the person who actually needs it, it is certainly very, very negative.
What is the medical onset issue, Dr. Brooks? How mysterious is that? You alluded to it before, that black men have an incidence of virulent prostate cancer that we don't understand. Is there research being done on that?
There's a great deal of research going on, but we do know that most of that difference in survival is related to access to care and the right kind of care. With regard to the screening tests that we have available, the digital rectal exam has already been discussed, and the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen blood test that Mr. McCord talked about. It's been shown that the PSA plus the digital rectal exam provides a little more information, but quite frankly, even with that combination, these are not highly reliable tests. So one thing that we clearly need are better screening tests.
Dr. Dorado Brooks is Director of Prostate and Colorectal Cancers for the American Cancer Society. Dr. Brooks, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, John.
And Elsie McCord, what do you think is the most important thing that you did in the beginning when you turned 50 that is responsible for your survival today for these 12 years?
I believe that me taking charge of my own health was a limiting factor, because if I had listened to the doctor, I probably would not have been screened.
Elsie McCord is a professor emeritus of biology at the New College of Florida. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer 12 years ago. Elsie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And to hear more of our work on the relationship between race, survival, and what it means to live with cancer, you can listen to our special podcast on The Takeaway's 6-month-long audio storytelling series, Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer. It tells the story of 3 African-American women battling breast cancer with the odds against them. You can find it at thetakeaway.org and click on the Weekender tab at the top of the page.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The 57th Annual Grammy Awards were last night. It's a celebrity show, of course, a music concert as well, and a public service announcement this year about domestic violence and human trafficking. The big headline, well, there were many, Taylor Swift and Kanye West are BFs now. All is forgiven from the ultimate awkward moment years ago. Winners were Beck, big surprise there, and newbie Sam Smith, also Pharrell Williams, Beyonce, and many others of the more usual suspects. With us on what the Grammys got right and wrong last night is John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC. Welcome back, John.
John, good to see you.
What'd you think they missed? What'd you think they got right?
Well, giving Beck Album of the Year, I thought, was a pretty good choice. Of that field of 5, this is continuing a long-standing occasional tradition of the Academy voting surprise albums of the year. Remember Herbie Hancock with The River, the Joni Mitchell Project. So I thought they got that right. I thought they got really lucky with a couple of their performances. And the one that stood out for me was Annie Lennox doing Screamin' Jay Hawkins, I Put a Spell on You, one of the best things I've seen at the Grammys in many years.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's great.
She looked terrific while she was doing it. I mean, that worked out really well. One of the other things they might have gotten lucky with was the revised ELO, which Jeff Lynne and company seemed like a random choice. But there was Paul McCartney in the front row, up and singing along and dancing until he noticed the camera. And then he kind of sheepishly sat back down. But it was a really nice moment, too.
Well, for some of the younger folks at the Grammys, do you think the winners reflected the state of music right now?
Well, sure. I mean, Sam Smith, all 22 years old, walking off with 4 Grammys, including 3 of the big 4. The only one he didn't get was Album of the Year,
which went
to Beck.
Right, right.
The funny thing, of course, with Sam Smith is 22 years old. He sounds like he could be 50, or 60. I mean, he's got that classic Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, Curtis Mayfield, Adele thing going, which the Academy loves. So not such a surprise that he had a very big night last night.
What did they get wrong at the Grammys?
Well, the field for Best Rock Album, I thought, was lacking. when they gave that award earlier in the day to Beck, I thought they were setting him up as a consolation prize. But of course, he ended up getting the big prize as well. You know, the U2 album that nobody wanted got a nomination.
Yeah, that was awful.
But a band like The War on Drugs, a band that got amazing reviews from rock critics, didn't get a sniff.
It's Red Eyes from The War on Drugs. And did you mean to say didn't get a sniff?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't get anything. Right.
Who won? Paramore?
Paramore, for Best Rock Song, I thought that was a really, really weak choice. I mean, the song itself is so light, it doesn't rock at all. It wasn't a great field. I thought that was one of the other things they got wrong. I also thought that St. Vincent was a deserving winner of Best Alternative Album, but I was disappointed that the English band James, who had a really terrific album last year, also did not get a nomination.
Yeah, I thought those two albums were terrific that you mentioned there. I mean, I think it was a great moment for that kind of music, but difficult to pick a winner. But Taylor Swift was snubbed.
Well,
that's
let's,
a good
let's
thing.
Remember that because of the weird Academy rules, she was only eligible for the one song, Shake It Off. We have not heard the last of Taylor Swift. Red, the album, will be eligible at this time next year. Expect her to add to her mantelpiece then.
Yes or no, have we heard the last of Iggy Azalea, another snub?
Oh, God, I hope so.
John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC on the Grammys. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I think we can all agree that this is a beautiful melody, set in the beautiful harmonies of composer Erik Satie. But exactly why is it beautiful? That's a more difficult proposition to agree on. What is beauty? We're asking that concise but anything but simple question this week. What is beauty? We gave you some parameters. Beauty in six words.
Living an honest, peaceful, and joyful life.
Oops, seven words there.
The feeling of timelessness surrounding me.
It's my goddaughter's smile greeting the day.
Nature's amazing systems working together harmoniously.
It makes my heart beat faster.
The ancient Greeks wrote a lot more than six words about beauty. The Greeks built a huge body of thought on the connection between beauty and sexuality, beauty and class, beauty and metaphysics. David Constan, author of Beauty, The Fortunes of an Ancient Greek Idea, says we owe our healthy and unhealthy notions of beauty in many cases to the artists and geniuses of Athens.
The word for beauty is kalos. It's the same root that we have in calisthenics and kaleidoscope. There was a very similar word that people didn't pay attention to just because it was so similar. It was by paying attention to that other word that I could see the specific notion of Greek beauty. The word that was most general was kalos, and the word that was more specific was kalos. You could see the difference in the accent, and one has only one L and one has two L's. In principle, the same root and very similar, but I had an intuition that the two had different ranges of meaning, and it was on investigating thousands of passages that I came finally to see that looking at the kalos would really tell us something about the specific sense of Greek beauty.
So you tell a woman she's kalos, it's like, fine. But if you really want to make an impression, it's kalos.
Kalos, absolutely, that she has or possesses kalos. I'll give you an example. When God created the world, he looked at the world and he said, it is good. In Greek, that's translated as the adjective kalos. God didn't mean it's beautiful. He meant it's a fine piece of work.
Not bad.
Not bad. Excellent. In Latin, it's translated as bonum, which is the Latin word for good, by St. Jerome in his Bible. Whereas kalos does, interestingly enough, have a corresponding word in Hebrew that also refers very specifically to physical attractiveness as opposed to things being good in general.
And is this a deep notion of beauty in the sense that it's a superficial kind of visual impression that we get?
Two questions always come up about beauty. One is, what kinds of things do people think are beautiful? Tall people or short people, heavy people or thin people. And we've seen those changes over the centuries. The other is, what does beauty do? That is, what is its effect? Does it make us admire something or does it make us attracted to something? The argument of my book was that beauty, as it was understood among the Greeks, put the emphasis on attractiveness, the emphasis on desire. And I'll give an example that makes this clear. As we know, there was a what we call Greek love was pederastic in the sense that it was usually an older person who felt a passion for a younger boy, a pubescent boy. And when you see the attribution, the ascription of beauty, it's rarely ascribed to adult males, but very commonly ascribed either to women or to boys. So that distribution of the terminology tells us something about how the Greeks understood beauty. If you've got a hero like a he-man, like Hercules, you don't want to say he's pretty.
We think of celebrities as superficial, but it sounds like the celebrity notion of beauty is closer to the classical notion of beauty in the ancient Greeks than anything we might find, you know, on a painting.
I would agree. Although you can have paintings and statues, as the Greeks themselves knew very well, that represent very beautiful people, so beautiful that we have stories of people who were sexually attracted to statues. That's a very curious thing. Even attempted copulating with statues.
Oh, great.
We have a technical name for it in modern psychotherapy. It's called agalmatophilia. And you're in love with a statue.
Museum guards have to worry about that.
They certainly did. One case in particular became very famous in antiquity.
You don't have to go into
I don't need to go into details. As far as standards of beauty, what is curious is the degree to which today, if we look at an ancient Greek statue of a god or a goddess, they seem to fit our standards of beauty. We don't have to argue that the Venus of the Milo or another one is beautiful, whereas there are periods and cultures, even medieval painting in our West, where we don't necessarily respond that way. We wouldn't say, seeing a celebrity who looked just like that medieval icon would make us think of beauty in the first place.
Looking at the way Greek beauty made its way outside of Greece, how did that work?
Well, here we move over from what the effect of beauty is to inspire desire to what it is that makes something beautiful. Why does this inspire desire rather than the other thing? And the Greeks thought about it as they thought about so many things. And one of the answers they came up with was symmetry and proportion. We have fragments, but fairly substantial fragments, of a work called The Canon by a sculptor who wrote a little manual and then also prepared a statue that would illustrate it. And the detail is remarkable. The hand should be such and such mathematical proportion of the forearm of the whole arm. The size of the head should be 1/7 the size of the entire body. And so they were very precise mathematical descriptions of proportion and symmetry. And these are recovered in the Renaissance and are part of the reason why our conception of what is a beautiful person is so similar to the Greeks.
Is there something about those proportions that have a sort of psychological meaning in the sense that our minds are cued into those proportions, or are we simply accustomed to them because we've seen them so much, and the Greeks might have picked some other ratios maybe, and we would be feeling the same way about those?
I'm inclined to think that these are cultural artifacts, but there are arguments that would suggest that attractiveness in this regard has a biological function. So we are taking, for example, measurements of women at the age when reproduction is most possible, also signs of health. There's one curious book called The Survival of the Prettiest, as opposed to The Survival of the Fittest, which places a lot of emphasis on the evolutionary aspect, and that would be transcultural. I myself have been looking at how beauty is described and the uses to which it is put in different societies, and that's more specifically culturally influenced.
All right. David Constan, that's great. That's fascinating stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, John.
David Constan is a classicist and author of Beauty, The Fortunes of an Ancient Greek Idea. And what does beauty mean to you? Tell us in 6 words or share a photo by tweeting us at The Takeaway with the hashtag #MyBeautyIs. That's our show today. Tomorrow, a conversation with a novelist whose mother set impossibly high expectations of beauty. This is The Beautiful Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.